Okay, last night of questions. Okay, first question. Just curious, is there any explanation of how bones turn to crystal? Thank you. Not anything that the scientific community would be interested in. It's just that certain level of purity somehow transforms the physical elements of a being, and something definitely changes. Just as I was walking in, Rick Center was saying that he had pictures of Ajahn Chah's at the chedi and on his iPad. And I suggested he could bring it down tomorrow and show people if they're interested. I've never seen it, so I mean, in a sense, I don't see what Rick has, so that. It's not easy to get a decent picture of it. You have to actually have to crawl up onto the jetty. I know. I mean, because I've done it to look. See when nobody's around. At what point did your practice change from serving yourself to end your own suffering, to selfless service? Well, I think it's been an ongoing change, ongoing transformation, and of course it's still an ongoing transformation. But just seeing after some years of, I think particularly after about five, six, 7 years of training and just really changing, although obviously seeing the benefit and seeing the example of Ajahn Chah, seeing the example of the people who trained under him, and that one is motivated and inspired to take that on more fully as a practice, seeing the fruits that come from that as well. It's actually a very, very beautiful sutta in the in the Majjhima Nikaya of after the Buddha has kind of given up on the community, because they're, this is in, where was that? Not Vaisali, in Kosambi, where the community was fighting, arguing, split. They wouldn't listen to the Buddha, so the Buddha went off and said, well. He went to a forest where a few of the monks were living and practicing. And they're practicing diligently and harmoniously, and the Buddha asks, and how is it that you live together diligently and harmoniously? And part of it was, he said, and I think, why don't I set aside what I want to do and do what's of benefit to the others? And it was just a very simple statement, but it's a, in terms, to be able to just drop the agenda of self and see what is actually a benefit, what's of useful, what's okay. I relinquished my anger as you suggested, and I had no idea what a heavy burden I was clinging to until it was gone. Thank you. Sadhu. Let's see. See what happens if it comes back. Okay. Would you describe how to cultivate and relax into quote unquote whole body breathing? What does that mean? Thank you. Well, I think one of the ways is because I think one of the things that we do with mindfulness of breathing or any meditation is we tend to try to really to hone in or to kind of refine the concentration, and it gets and even that sort of one-pointed concentration, which is talked about, and then it narrows on what we're attending to, so that the Buddha talks about that, breathing in, breathing out, being experiencing the whole body, and one has to just experiment and there isn't as if it's any one particular technique, but it's being present with the experience of within the body, and then one can move the awareness around. One can be just experiencing, feeling what the sensation is as we breathe in, and how do we experience that in the area of the head? How do we experience that in the shoulders, the arms? How do we experience that in the trunk of the body? How do we experience that in the lower body? And then another way of approaching that idea of one-pointed, which is a one way of translating the word ekagata, another way of translating that, and just as valid, is unified. So that how does the breath become unified with the experience of the body? And how do we... there's a sphere of experience that doesn't have to be narrow and tight. It can be a bit more global. And this is where that aspect of, developing an agility of mind, where one is allowing the mind to be a bit more flexible and agile in the way that it attends to the experience, so that there's an opportunity to engage, to be interested, to explore, to settle, to recognizing that there's actually a whole world of experience that we can be attending to without it getting too narrow and tight. And of course, fundamental criterion, what is it that helps the mind to be clear and settled? So exploring that, looking at that. How much did the Buddha encourage his disciples to become enlightened, to quote-unquote get off the wheel, versus experiencing freedom from suffering in this lifetime. Those are actually exactly the same thing. Those are that's actually the same thing, because the experience of freedom from suffering in this time is exactly the same as become enlightened, to free oneself from the getting off the wheel of samsara, the cycle of birth and death. It's exactly the same thing. What do you see as the future for women ordaining in Theravada Buddhism? Metta for this retreat. I think it's already happening, and I think as long as there are women taking ordination and training and growing in the Dhamma, then it'll take root, and it will because it's more around it's fulfilling a need, so that when when there are those examples of women taking ordination and training, then that will continue to grow and create momentum. Okay. In the chant, 10 subjects for frequent recollection, what does, quote, one who has gone forth mean? Anyone on the path or only monastics? If it refers to people on the path, what does it mean, quote, my very life is sustained through the gifts of others? Thank you for your teachings. Well, in this case, particular case, the chant is actually it's lifted right from the suttas, and it's encouragement directly to the monastics. So that's a teaching that the Buddha gave to the monastics. So it's the word is pabbahajita. So one who's gone forth, one who's taken ordination. But as is the case in many and most of the teachings that are directed to monastics, generally they'll have a very direct application for anyone who's practicing. In this case, I say, my very life is sustained through the gifts of others. That's a direct admonishment and encouragement for those who are monastics and who do live on the offerings as our life prescribes and our training makes it kind of impossible to have an independent livelihood, but that doesn't mean that can't be extrapolated or extending the logic, because certainly I think it's important to recognize that as human beings living in society, in culture, that we have layers of interdependence and relying on each other in many different ways. The American ideal of the kind of the rugged individual who's completely independent, doesn't really hold up as a human way of existing. As human beings, we inevitably have webs of relationship and dependence and contact that we need to honor and be sensitive to, so that even though it's not, say, maybe directly say applicable, of my very life is sustained through the gifts of others, it's not much of a extension of logic to recognize, oh yeah, I can make that applicable, I can make that useful for me as a reflection. This is a very important question. Can we talk at breakfast, please? Yes. the noble silence would be lifted after the morning puja. So, breakfast. Okay. How can one work with feeling the element of water? In sitting meditation or walking meditation, the other three are easier for me to sense. By the way, I saw a plastic water bottle today with the label "reborn bottle" because it was made of 50% recycled plastic. Does this mean that water bottles are also made of elements and are not self? Absolutely. Absolutely. These are... Absolutely not self. with the water element, an easy way is just paying attention to the sensation of touch within the mouth. I mean, there's almost always going to be some fluid, saliva there, water element, very apparent. As sitting in meditation, where you can start feeling the pulse of the body, then you can sort of knowing that pulse of the heartbeat is there's a blood element fluid coming through the body. One can experience the eyes, whether they're if they're not sort of dry and scratchy, then means that there's water element there. So that the water element is all around us and all through us. In the supreme praise of the Dhamma and the Sangha, why are the Dhamma and Sangha referred to as my Lord? Dhamma is my Lord and guide. And then also adding, thank you for your consideration and patience in answering our questions. I think in this sense, the word Lord is not, as I used it this afternoon or this morning in the talk, but more like master, or it's hard to. In the English language, there's a couple. Lord is also in like Old English. It's more like your that who one gives deference to, and that one has a respect towards as having some as a master that one looks towards for guidance and out of deference and respect. hints. And these are particularly, these translations were done in England, so that that has a stronger connotation than certainly in American. I had a hard time getting up this morning. Then I had the thought, this is not mine, I am not this thought. That helped a lot. Any other advice on getting up? Getting up with alacrity hasn't worked for me. Is that it's the? But it is a great way of recognizing this. Oh yeah, this is not mine. This is not the thought. Because this, usually when it's morning time. Some people find it easier to get up in the morning. Some people don't find it so easy getting up in the morning. And then if one finds it difficult, then there's going to be a whole constellation of thoughts around it, an aversion or resistance. And then to recognize, okay, this is not mine. I'm not this thought. That's just another thought. It's time to get up, whether I like it or don't like it, or whether I even particularly want to. Right now, I'm committed to, and that's where, like that, with the cultivation of barmy. That's a skillful way of using. Okay, that say like taking a period of time where you've come to a retreat, and then say, okay, I'm going to really make the resolve to get up in the morning. And adhidhana barami, cultivation of resolution. And it's helpful to set resolutions one that you're pretty confident you can do, and at a time limit that is reasonable, so that you don't make it so idealistic that first day, second day, forget this. I just can't do it. So that the one builds up that confidence within oneself of, I can do that. Because that the resolution is still fresh. So that just using resolution of those recollections of putting forth of effort, saying, "All right, I've got the opportunity to put forth effort," and sort of turning the alarm off and rolling over again isn't quite the kind of the epitome of application of effort. you say, "Okay, I can put forth effort, put energy in," and so that seeing, okay, these are ways of building up kind of effort and energy, and it's in little increments, and you build up a kind of momentum and familiarity and confidence that one can do it. It was a couple of days ago. One of the monks was saying how they'd, because we had, I'm not sure how many years ago, it's a few years ago, and did a winter retreat using the theme of wirya, of effort. So did lots of readings and explanations around cultivation of effort. It's on CD, all these recordings, and the monk said, I have to confess, I've got that CD, and but I haven't really got past the first two talks, and I keep falling asleep. It's not an easy thing, going against the grain of what we're what we're used to. Sometimes just with the really setting the intention, like at the in the morning, sometimes that's already too late. But so then setting the intention in the evening, and you know, making that really clear. Okay, I'm going to get up in the morning, and then laying down, say like on a classic way that the Buddha described, you know, laying down on one's right hand side, and setting mindfulness. Okay, I'm going to wake up at such a time. And setting that intention really helps to, because you carry things through, and if you just sort of just kind of conk out, and then the alarm goes. But it's you know, really composing oneself in the evening and setting an intention, and the alarm goes, oh, right, I was going to get up. It's been working kind of in the programs have been working in the background. So it was easier to wake up. One of the best ways of one of the monks that I know, he had trouble waking up in the morning, getting up in the morning. And so he would set his alarm clock kind of out of reach, so he'd have to reach over to put it off, turn it off. But then he'd prepare his toothbrush at night and put toothpaste on his toothbrush. And so in order to turn it off, he had to lift his toothbrush up. So he'd push it up, push it in his mouth, and then he had to get up. That's really effective. Okay. There's two aspects. Oh, you mentioned that Ajahn Chah stated that samadhi should be accompanied by alertness. Does this mean that jhana should not be a quote-unquote zoned out state, as some meditation teachers instruct? Because, so for example, TM meditation, which I didn't realize that or know. Yeah, absolutely. Of course, Ajahn Chah very explicit in terms of the whatever level of samadhi, for it to be right samadhi, samma samadhi, there should be that quality of awareness and alertness, presence of attention there, of knowing. That's an important facet of samma samadhi. It's also interesting just taking a look at the descriptions that the Buddha himself gives of the, say, of the jhanas, and when the Buddha describes them, and I won't go into the details, but there's one is the importance of the kind of the body based experience, and then that kind of knowledge and awareness and well being that is suffused through the body, the interaction, interplay that one has both approaching and and engaging in those states of stability. The most beautiful description is in the Maha Asapura Sutta. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. I can't remember the number. Anybody wants to look it up at that? I'd encourage it. And thank you. Awesome teachings. Also, what are the four aspects of, with a question mark behind it, of bhavana you mentioned? What I was referring to, the establishing of mindfulness, how the Buddha describes cultivation of mindfulness, so that the first one being the, in Pali, ātāpi, which is the application of effort for the burning up of obstructions. The second aspect is sampajanya, sampajhano is sampajanya, which is the clear comprehension. Third one is satima, which means, say, possessed of mindfulness or alertness, presence. And the fourth one being the vinaya lokeya bichato manasa, sort of leading out from the habits of liking and disliking, or wanting and not wanting, that tie us to the world. So that's a how, when the Buddha describes mindfulness, that's how he describes it. I've been experiencing a similar type of irritation as Debbie had mentioned in her talk. I feel I'm present as it arises and think I'm letting it go, only to find it's turned into a big clump of irritation. I'm still unclear as to how to work with this. Please advise. But just the recognizing of that, because when it's recognized, it's that's suffering, it's painful, so that then there's the motivation to try to see it more clearly, or to be able to relinquish it more fully, or to transform the irritation into something more say, attentive to empathy, because oftentimes that irritation is just sort of, it's already the function of irritation to shut things out usually. So then attending to kind of the empathy in terms of, okay, what is it that I'm feeling? What is it that how am I relating to the people or world around me? So then it's starting to tune in a bit more clearly. And it's always, the patience, of course, is the it's always one of the critical factors of how to working with these very fundamental defilements and habits and tendencies, and it really does take time. So that having the patience to keep reflecting, keep investigating, and keep working with it. On page 23 in the chanting book, there is no self in the created or the uncreated. Does this statement conceal an asymmetry? Surely we investigate the created to separate from it, but can we investigate the uncreated? And if so, is it not to identify with it? Thank you for sharing your wisdom with us. The I have to come back to the Pali. Because the in the chant, what is sabbe sankhara anicca sabbe dhamma anatta? So that's what's being translated, isn't that what's there? It's exactly it. How does it translate? The first line get translated into English?
All things are impermanent.
All conditions are impermanent. Okay. So that sankhara what is a condition is formulated so that one can. And of course, all sankharas are anatta as well. But then, also, dhammas is a much broader term because it's like phenomena, so that even nibbana is a dhamma. In a sense, that it's a phenomena, it's a thing. So that all dhammas are so both the all sankharas, all things which are conditions, and the unconditioned is also not self. One can't establish a sort of an I, me, and mine. Not only in the sankharas, in the conditions, but in the unconditioned, in the uncreated, one can't say this is there is an I, me, and mine within this. So that's and it's more like, and we can investigate the uncreated in the sense that recognizing that there is a sphere where there is no suffering. There is such a thing as nibbana, and it's actually helpful to investigate it, to reflect on it, to consider it, in order to try to bring life to it, try to make it something that's actually tangible, possible, but we can't identify with it as this is I, me, mine. We can't create that kind of identity around it. Okay. Do you miss Ajahn Amaro? Yeah, I mean, we both miss each other. Neither of us dwell on it, but I just spent a couple of weeks in England. We've determined to say alternate visits, so that I go to I went to England this year. I went 2 years ago. Last year, Ajahn Amaro came, and we already looked at his calendar for next year for him to come and visit us. So that, he and I, we have close friendship. And we were talking about it today, and I think at tea time, I guess. And saying how different we are, it was a very fruitful time of sharing, kind of co-abbots of the monastery together, and teaching together, and learning from each other, because we are so different. But it was, and people were in Thailand when we were first, when I first sort of said, "Oh, yeah, we'll help Ajahn Amaro set up a monastery in California," and the two of us sharing the duties of abbot and senior Thai monks. How's that going to work? They said, it's like two tigers sharing the same cave. It doesn't sound like it's going to work. But it did. Okay. Thank you for your inspiring teachings and dedicated life. Two questions. One, I seem to recollect that the Buddha cautioned against unwholesome thoughts in a way that seemed to raise their results as similar to an unwholesome action, not just, for example, as a caution against cultivating bad patterns or habits, but as producing manifest external as well as internal results, karmically. Is this so? Yeah, I mean, it's always actions of body, speech, and mind. It isn't as if, the mind's just a minor thing and the body and speech is really the big deal. Or it isn't. It's all of a piece. And of course the mind is what generates the intention, volitions, which inclines toward certain actions and speech, so that we're paying attention to the thoughts and thought patterns, because they don't just they don't just stay inside. Just thinking, there was that years ago when George Bush was the president. There was this great comedy skit that somebody did as kind of an imitation, and of course he says some outrageous thing, and he said, "Oop, that was an inside thought." I wasn't supposed to come outside. Okay, and the second one, there's no room for two. So, no room for the second question. Okay, does the fifth precept include coffee or prescription drugs as drugs to avoid? Does the precept mean never drink alcohol or don't abuse alcohol for laypersons? There are thousands of stores and restaurants that serve and or sell alcohol, drugs, coffee. Does right livelihood mean one cannot work in one, or does it mean don't work where alcohol and drugs are made? One of the things important to point to is that these precepts are what we ourselves are determined to do, and seeing the benefit in them, then one keeps them. It isn't as if anybody's going around checking on you. But the fifth precept doesn't include, coffee or prescription drugs, or tea. It's sort of, because the precept is, some kind of intoxicant that really affects the fundamental mindfulness. Although there are some people who you shouldn't be giving coffee to. We have a monk at the monastery like that.
toxic.
But in general, it's more the it's the word is sula merlia madhya pamadadana, so that it's pointing particularly to the alcohol and drugs, which are a basis for heedlessness, so that the actual precept is a restriction against the actual the taking of that intoxicant. As opposed to don't take too much of it. But it's more around the actual substance. And then whether one chooses to follow it or not follow it, or how one interprets it, but the actual precept is the precept against the actual substance or substances. And then, in terms of livelihood, I think as one, especially as one is paying attention to livelihood. And there's a whole spectrum of how one could be holding it. Once one has a foundation for oneself, and has a standard that one wants to hold for oneself, then the actual working in a place that sells alcohol, then one would have to be recognizing, how's this affecting my life? How's it affecting my relationships with others? How's it affecting my relationship with my practice? How's it affecting my relationship with my commitment to Dhamma? Because some places it wouldn't really matter. Say restaurants, it's kind of like that. I mean, we have a lot of Thai people come up, and Thai restaurant owners, and and if they're committed to Dhamma, but then they have a restaurant that to be a restaurant at a certain level of service and popularity, then you almost always have to be serving alcohol. How do they deal with that? There's a conflict that many of them have, because they don't feel good about it, but they also want to make a livelihood. Different people will deal with it in different ways. So, I don't have the a magic solution for it. But I think it's in, you know, as we reflect on it, just paying attention, say, on an individual basis, it's fairly clear in the sense, okay, well, how to, as a livelihood, then a particular workplace, how does it affect me? Does it actually create problems for my my own Dhamma practice or my own ability to keep a standard of virtue and conduct that I feel good about? Today is the 23rd anniversary of my grandmother's passing. Up until I met Ajahn Amaro and later you and other monks, she had been the kindest, most compassionate, happy, forgiving, and caring person I knew. I'm particularly thinking of her today and realize she might be back into a 23 or younger man or woman body. So I am dedicating a loving-kindness meditation to her soul, this probable person alive somewhere. Is this a meritorious act, or is this fantasy? Thank you. Well, I'm biased. So I think it's a meritorious act. So that's my... and, you know, and the reality is, yeah, we don't quite know where she would be, but that memory and that well-wishing, that I don't think that sort of disappears into a void anywhere. And certainly, at any wholesome act and a dedication of merit, the first person who benefits is ourselves. And our own minds, our own hearts are uplifted with that. Please explain the difference between aggregates and faculties. Thank you for your kindness. The aggregates is a fairly common translation for the what are called the five aggregates, the five khandhas. And that's the aggregate. Khanda, I think, literally means like lump or something. So that it's the lump of the body, the lump of feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. These little piles of categories of experience that the Buddha used to say this is this constellation of things comprise our what we tend to identify with as me. Then faculties, and particularly faculties is a word that is actually that I say that I use today, indriya, those are like the spiritual faculties, spiritual qualities of faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. So these are sort of spiritual qualities, spiritual faculties that we can rely on for cultivation and development. Okay, and the last question. What is the difference between ignorance and delusion? In what's normally translated as avijja, ignorance, is usually translated from the word avijja, and vijja is like true knowledge, and avijja is lack of true knowledge. So then that tends to be just trying to find, that's a bit long, So they try to find one word, so ignorant, so that the word that it's coming from is kind of a lack of true knowledge, so that ignorance of the true nature of things. Delusion is from the word moha, and that comes from the three fundamental roots of defilement, the things that stain the heart. So greed, hatred, and delusion. Lobha, dosa, moha. Moha is more of the clouded, confused quality of mind that takes one into either doubt, uncertainty, confusion, all that kind of area. And ignorance is sort of is a bit more global in its use, in the sense of ignorance would be the root of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's because we have that lack of true knowledge, clear vision and understanding, then we end up drawn into habits of greed, of hatred, delusion. So that kind of that quality of avijja or ignorance is feeding the whole mass. So delusion is a bit more specific, a bit more. But it is in terms of the three roots of defilements that stain the mind and lead to suffering, that's one of them. Okay, so we'll have a short break and come back for evening chanting and sitting.